We appreciate the courtesy of the makers of Palmolive Soap, sponsors of Hilltop House, and the makers of Colgate Tooth Powder, sponsors of Stepmother, in relinquishing their programs this morning in order for us to bring you the following special broadcast. Hilltop House and Stepmother will be heard as usual next Monday.
The President of the United States starts his transcontinental trip. Where the Muskingum River flows into the winding Ohio in this old city of Marietta, Ohio, the President makes the first stop in his speaking tour of the nation, pausing on this first day out of Washington to dedicate a Gutzon-Borglum monument, memorial to the start westward of the nation. In Marietta, first settlement of the old Northwest Territory, some 20,000 people have gathered in Muskingum Park, the tree-lined esplanade which lines the river, to watch the President unveil the heroic memorial to those pioneers who first carried the American form of government west of the 13 original states. On this spot, where 150 years ago, Arthur St. Clair stood under the shade of these trees to be inaugurated the first governor of the Northwest Territory, thousands are now waiting for the Reverend Joseph E. Hands from Brother Dutton School of Beloit, Wisconsin, to pronounce the invocation. In a moment or two, Father Hands will mount to the rostrum. Here he is, the invocation. Now begins our ceremonies in Marietta.
We thank thee, Son of the living God, for the wisdom of 1787. We thank thee for our forebears, the hardy pioneers that trekked to the west to widen the pale of this country and its benisons. We thank thee for the divine spur that led the founding fathers of old to pen Article 3 of the compact. We ask thee now to forgive us the trespasses of the times and to lead us back to thy love and thy law. We pray thee that a deep desire be reborn in us for the trinity of religion, morality, and knowledge. This, the sole objective of schools and the means of education in the ancient true sense. This, that in the words of Daniel Carroll, we may ever be one undivided and independent nation. This, that in the hope of Lincoln, we may ever be a nation under God. This, that hallowed be thy name in all the land, in every part of it. We beg thee on our knees, in summer of weal and winter of woe, to bind us all, high place and low, close to the ideals of a sacred past, so clearly traced for us in that writ of wisdom, the ordinance of 1787. Amen.
Now the President is to be introduced by the Honorable George White, Chairman of the Federal Commission for the Northwest Territory Celebration.
Mr. President, fellow citizens, here today on this historic and hallowed spot where the first settlement in the great Northwest was fixed, on behalf of the six states, Ohio, Indiana, Wisconsin, Illinois, Minnesota, and Michigan, and my fellow commissioners of this Northwest Territory celebration, I welcome our nation's president. It was not our choosing, but our God-given good fortune that here at Marietta, where we stand today, is the place which 150 years ago became the threshold, the stepping stone to the vast hinterland to the west, the south, and the north. But that movement, Mr. President, seems to have been predestined to give occasion for an ordinance that became national, that supplied the principles and guarantees to the people's future security and freedom, which were necessary to round out our government, the mother of all West world democracies. I am asking you, my fellow citizens, in honor of our great forebears, and as hosts, to salute the President of the United States.
Governor Davey, Senator Bulkley, Chairman White, and you, the people of the Northwest Territory. A long time ago in Washington, two old friends of mine came to the White House, Bob Bulkley and Bob Sechrist, to ask me to come to Marietta in 1938. And it seemed a long ways off. But I promised them that I'd come if I possibly could. So here I am. Long before that famous year of 1788, there were white men here. White men, to use a biblical phrase, spying out this land of Canaan. An intrepid outpost breed they were, the scouts and the skirmishers of the great American migration. The sight of smoke from a neighbor's chimney might have worried them a great deal, but the Indians and the Redcoats did not. Long before 1788, at Kaskaskia and Vincennes, with scant help from the seaboard, they had held their beloved wilderness for themselves and for us, held it with their own bare hands and their own long rifles. But their symbol is Vincennes, not Marietta. Here, with all honor to those scouts and skirmishers, we are celebrating the coming of a different type of men and women. The first battalions of that organized army of occupation, which transplanted from across the Alleghenies whole little civilizations that took root and grew. They were giving expression to a genius for organized colonization, carefully planned and ordered under the law. The men who came here before 1788 came as Leif Erikson's men did to Vineland, in a spirit all of adventure. But the men and women of the Ohio Company who came to Marietta came rather like the men and the women of the Massachusetts Bay Colony to Boston, an organized society, unafraid to meet temporary adventure, but serious in seeking permanent security for men and women and children and homes. Many of them were destined to push on, but most of them came here intending to stay. People like that may not be the first to conquer the earth, but they will always be the last to possess the earth. Right behind them, the men and women who established Marietta 150 years ago moved that instrument of law and order and cooperation, the instrument of government. A representative of the national government entered Marietta to administer the Northwest Territory under the famous Northwest Ordinance. And what we are celebrating today is this establishment of the first civil government west of the original 13 states. Three provisions of that ordinance I always like to remember. It provided that no person demeaning himself in a peaceable and orderly manner shall ever be molested on account of his mode of worship or for religious sentiment in the said territory. And it provided that religion, morality, and knowledge, being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and means of education shall forever be encouraged. And it provided, finally, for the perpetual prohibition of slavery in the territory. Free, educated, God-fearing men and women, that is what the 13 states hoped that the new West would exemplify. And the new West has well fulfilled that hope. Every generation meets substantially the same problems under its own different set of circumstances. Anyone speculating on our great migration westward is struck by the human parallel between the driving force behind that migration and the driving force behind the great social exploration that we are carrying on today. Most of the people who went out to Ohio in the early days and who followed wave on wave for another 100 years went to improve their economic lot. In other words, they were following the same yearning for security that is driving us forward today. At the end of the wagon ruts, there was something worth the physical risk. The standard of life in a log cabin, amid fields still blackened with half-burned stumps, was not high, but it was fairly certain. A family, or at most a township, could be a whole self-satisfying, self-sufficient economic system. Plenty of food to eat if a man would but reach out and shoot it or cultivate it. Plenty of warm clothes if the women of the family were willing to spin. Always a tight roof over the family's head if the little community would respond to the call for a roof raising. Whatever he used was a man's own, belonged to him. He had the solid joy of possession, of owning his home, and owning his own means of livelihood. And if things did not pan out here, there was always an infinite self-sufficiency beckoning further westward to new land, new game, and new opportunity. Under such conditions, there was so much to get done that men could not get done alone that the frontiersmen naturally reached out to government as their greatest single instrument of cooperative self-help, with the aid of which they could get things done. To them, the use of government was but another form of the cooperation of good neighbors. Government was an indispensable instrument of their daily lives, of the security of their women and children, of their homes, and their opportunities. They looked on government not as a thing apart, as a power over people. They regarded government as a power of the people, as a democratic expression of organized self-help, just like the frontier husking bee, only on a bigger scale. There were worried legalists back east in the seaboard towns who were sure that it was unconstitutional for the federal government to help put roads and railways and canals through these new territories, who were sure that the nation would never get back the money that it was plowing into development of the natural and human resources of the Northwest Territory. But Abraham Lincoln, who incarnated the spirit of the people who are actually living in the states making up the Northwest Territory, summed up their attitude when he said, "The legitimate object of government is to do for a community of people whatever they need to have done, but cannot do at all, or cannot do so well for themselves in their separate and individual capacities." And so today, under new conditions as a whole nation, the American people, the original 13 states, and all of the West and the South that has grown out of them, they are on a mental migration, dissatisfied with old conditions, seeking, like the little band that came to Marietta, seeking to create new conditions of security. And again, the people see an ally in their own government. Many a man does not own his cabin anymore, or the house or the flat that he lives in. His possessions maybe some furniture, and perhaps a bank account. Scarcely any man can call upon his neighbors to help him build his home anymore. Today, he pays a contractor cash and has to have mortgage financing to find the cash. And if that financing is of the wrong kind or goes bad, he may need help to save his home from foreclosure. Once upon a time, old age was safe because there was always something useful that men and women, no matter how old, could do to earn an honorable maintenance. That time is gone, and some new kind of organized old age insurance has to be provided. In these perplexities, what happens? The individual turns, as he has always turned, to the collective security of the wilderness, of the willingness of his fellows to cooperate through the use of government to help him and each other. The spirit of the frontier husking bee is found today in carefully drafted statutes. Statutes insuring bank deposits. Statutes providing mortgage money for homes through the Federal Housing Administration. Statutes providing help through the Homeowners Loan Corporation for those in danger of foreclosure. The cavalry captain of the old days, who protected the log cabins of the Northwest, is now supplanted by legislators, men like Senator Bulkley, toiling over the drafting of such statutes and over the efficiency of government machinery to administer them, so that such protection and help of government can be extended to the full. Yes, on 1,000 fronts, government, state government, municipal government, county government, as well as federal, is playing the same role of the insurer of security for the average man, woman, and child that the army detachments played in the early days of the old Northwest Territory. When you think it through, at the bottom of most of the great protective statutes of today, there is the fact that in essence they are mutual insurance companies. And our recent legislation is not a departure from, but a return to the healthy practices of mutual self-help of the early settlers of the Northwest. Let us not be afraid to help each other. Let us never forget that government is ourselves and not an alien power over us. The ultimate rulers of our democracy are not a president, not senators and congressmen and government officials. The ultimate rulers of our democracy are the voters of the country itself. I believe that the American people, not afraid of their own capacity to choose forward-looking representatives to run their government, want the same cooperative security, and that they have the same courage to achieve it in 1938 as in 1788. And I am sure they know that we will always have a frontier of social problems and economic problems, and that we must always move in to bring law and order to the solution of that problem. In that confidence, In that confidence, I don't think I have to tell you that I am pushing on. And I am sure that the people of the nation will push on with me. And now, I understand that somebody is going to pull the strings. And I hereby dedicate this great monument commemorating 150 years of Americanism.
This is the Gutzon Memorial, Gutzon Borgner Memorial, dedicated at Marietta, Ohio, as the President of the United States, with one final wave of his Panama hat, prepares to return to the presidential train in the continuation of his transcontinental speaking tour, which has been so long awaited. The monument which now stands revealed was pushed aside as the band played the Star Spangled Banner. The President, with a few informal remarks, announced that he understood someone was to pull the strings, and this monument was unveiled by a new sort of string pulling with three great white screens decorated with the patriotic red, white, and blue colors. These three great screens were moved aside on rollers by ladies and gentlemen dressed appropriately in colonial costume, three-colored hats and very warm embroidered coats and knee breeches. At the moment, the Marietta High School Band, in orange coats and black trousers, is holding forth on this day, the greatest in all Marietta's history since Marietta's founding 150 years ago, when American civil government first found its way westward across the Allegheny Mountains, and the start westward of what is now the United States of America was then assured. The monument consists of three great heroic-sized figures carved out of the largest block of stone ever brought to this small town on the confluence of the Ohio and the Muskingum Rivers. The three figures are pioneers stepping out of a boat. Behind them come a woman and another man, the man helping the woman out. They're stepping out of the boat, which is landing on the shore here, and facing toward the west and toward the start of the empire, which they are marching on to found. A burst of applause from the other side indicates that the president's party are now leaving in their motorcade to drive two blocks to the railroad station and to the presidential train, which arrived in Marietta at 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time and which leaves at 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time headed west. The next stop on this speaking tour of the chief executive of the United States will be Covington, Kentucky, where at 4:30 Eastern Daylight Saving Time, the president will make another address, for the first one on Kentucky soil in this fast-moving speaking tour. The next day, Saturday, the presidential train will have chugged across the Mississippi River. And in Oklahoma City, the president will leave the train once again for a quick motor trip to the Oklahoma City Fairgrounds for another address to the nation, which will be broadcast on this Columbia network. The 20,000 people jamming into the streets, straining at the wires, pushing back the Boy Scouts and giving the gray-clad Marietta police quite a time, are waiting for one last glimpse of the chief executive of the United States, the first time that a president has ever visited this small town, this first really capital of the old Northwest Territory, a territory which embraces land which now forms six states. And if I remember correctly, there are Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, and perhaps I've forgotten one. Well, that's five or six, as a matter of fact. The president's car, with Marvin McIntyre in a straw hat and a tropical worsted summer suit trying to get into it, is now stalled as the photographers clustered around
like flies flicking their camera flash bulbs like fireflies, make one last attempt to get pictures of a president of the United States in Marietta, Ohio. A couple of Secret Service men in Panama hats, also on the running board of that car, Mr. George White, the chairman of the Federal Commission for this Marietta celebration, sitting in the car with the president. The troopers lined up two great ranks, one in khaki, the second in gray shirts, lined up on their motorcycles, ready to start the motorcade on its winding way through town to the railroad station only two blocks away. Citizens of Marietta in all sorts of costumes, from 10-gallon Western hats to Indian costumes and to old colonial costumes, pushing up through this crowd, which is the greatest crowd, the largest number of people which have ever been in this small town. Another burst of applause. Listen. Hands are waved, handkerchiefs are fluttered. People call one more greeting as the president prepares to leave the city which he arrived in only about 40 or 50 minutes ago. Meanwhile, as the crowds push through this tree-lined park, this lovely green strip along the bank of the Muskingum River, spectators are still dropping like flies in the heat of this very hot summer day. It's early here in Marietta. In fact, it's not quite 10 o'clock, but the heat is coming in through the weeping willow trees and through the elms which dot the tree-lined esplanade of Muskingum Park, and before long it's going to be hot indeed, which means that it will be hot in Covington, Kentucky, but nonetheless the president will arrive there this afternoon and will speak. And now, as members of the White House party, members of the press who have sat along the long tables in front of the president's stand, typing their stories, filing their stories with the telegraph companies as the president actually spoke, as these members of the press, as the photographers and newsreel cameramen too are leaving their stand, hurrying into the motor cars to make the train, the representatives of the radio networks who have equipment to pack must also make haste in order to catch the presidential train, travel across country, and so bring you the next address of the president at Covington, Kentucky, this afternoon, 4:30 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time. And so this is Bob Trout speaking from Marietta, Ohio. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.